Hello, everybody. I'm George from Ireland. Well, this is a very belated happy birthday to my late and long lamented fellow Irishman, Edmund Burke. It being the 12th of January was his birthday. Of course, that's, you know, going by the Gregorian calendar. When he was alive, was only when he was born anyway, the British Isles went by the Julian calendar. It was only like 1752 that Ireland and Great Britain caught up with the continent. Anyway, so he's best known as being a philosopher and a member of Parliament. So his birthday is 12th of January, if we go by new style. So Elsett Burke's best known for, I suppose, Reflections on the Revolution in France, something I didn't read till I was about 28. Okay, so he's born in Dublin, and his father was Richard Burke, a well-to-do solicitor. So Edmund Burke was baptised, confirmed at the Church of Ireland, which is the church as by law established in Ireland at the time, not since 1870. What else? So that was vital because only members of the Church of Ireland, 15% of the population maximum, had full membership of the political nation. And now there was a Richard Burke who's recorded as converting from Catholicism to the Church of Ireland. Was that his father? They're not clear. But anyway, his father's well-to-do in his legal practice. And his mother, Mary Nagle, came from rural Cork, I think North Cork, and she was a Catholic. But crucially, Edmund was brought up in his father's Protestant denomination. And indeed, his mother was a cousin of a very well-known nun, Nano Nagle. And there's even a Nano Nagle bridge in Cork. So I think he went to stay with his Catholic relatives in the countryside from time to time. But his ancestors were Anglo-Normans, had been in Ireland for centuries. But okay, so he'd gone to Trinity College Dublin, graduated from there, and he established the Historical Society, which is still going today. Despite the word historical, it's mostly a debating society. And another Ed Burke, and Edward Burke, was auditor of it, as in president, in about 2002. Then he went on to London, where he was called to the bar at the Middle Temple and so on. But he didn't actually practice law. He had a bit of a grand tour and so on. So then he began to work as an editor for well-known writers and politicians and things like that. And that's when he produced his satire, Vindication of a Natural Society, A View of the Miseries and Evils Arising to Mankind. So he was involved in, the Whig Party, all right? And he disbelieved in the notion of the divine right of kings. And he believed in the gradual political evolution, that the franchise was extended only to a tiny segment of the population, perhaps 5% of men, the people who were with major real property, but gradually extended to more and more. But the crucial word was gradually, not too fast, because they were the swinish multitude in his own formulation. And this unlettered, uncultured masses that were just benighted, they were really a mob. And we shouldn't let the mobile vulgus have too much power, because such a person might want oppression, might want to take away habeas corpus or a fair trial or property or free expression and so forth. And they will be too easily gulled by silver-tongued demagogues and so forth. And you've got to remember just how unlettered most people were in those days. So he was no mean philosopher. He appreciated the arts, both the plastic arts and the others. That's why he penned a philosophical inquiry into the origin of ideas of the sublime and the beautiful and so forth. So he was an admirer of the German philosopher Immanuel Kant and the French writer Denis Diderot, although he's rather scatological and even pornographic what he wrote, Diderot, his Confessions of a Nun, and so forth. He also was a friend of the painter Sir Joshua Reynolds. So he wrote a history of England and so forth. So he spent almost his entire adult life in Ireland. Now, one of the reasons that he was sympathetic was the Catholic majority in Ireland, and we were discriminated against by law at the time, is he married a Catholic woman, Mary Jane Nugent, and they had children, her father being a doctor, one of very few Catholic doctors in Ireland at the time, because higher education was really only for Protestants. They ran the only university, Trinity College Dublin, which is even open to Catholics, till the 1790s. So they had two sons and no daughters, a very small family for the time. And so they finally got elected to represent Wendover in Buckinghamshire, and it's run by an Irish peer, Lord Fermanagh. Okay, so It was he had complete control over it because very, very few people had the right to vote there. So he seemed to be rather radical in his views, believing that the American colonies, there should be major concessions to them, anything short of independence, that would calm the situation and good relations could be restored. So looking back to the 17th century, he thought Cromwell was right and things like that. He thought that William of Orange was right to overthrow his father-in-law and uncle, James II, and so forth. So he wrote thoughts on the cause of the present discontents, talking about the American situation. Okay. So anyway, he was he knew Charles James Fox, a fellow Whig, but Fox was rather more radical than he was. The best biography you should read is The Great Melody by the late Conor Cruise O'Brien, also Irish academic, methinks barrister, also attended Trinity College Dublin. Fortunately died, my goodness, almost 20 years ago. I very much lament that I never met Conor Cruise O'Brien, who was the same age as the state. He was opposed to the third partition of Poland. He really admired Poland having parliamentary government and thought it was disliked the way it was really broken up by these absolutist monarchies, Russia, Prussia and Austria. Later, he was elected MP for Bristol, okay, the second biggest city in the country at that time. And there was a proper election, which people really were free to vote. They didn't have to vote this way or that way by being fear of being sacked or being evicted or whatever. Okay, so it was a major port. And obviously, one of the big things then is it made a lot of its money through slavery. But he didn't seem to criticize that at all. He wanted free trade for Ireland because Ireland were trading Great Britain and the colonies a lot. And of course, we had to pay whatever, import taxes to import things into Great Britain or the colonies and so on. And he said, no, that shouldn't be the case. And so many people in Ireland are agitating for this, which would obviously bind us closer to Great Britain. And obviously, if you're a nationalist, you shouldn't want that. But rather hypocritically, many nationalists did. He was against the penal laws in Ireland, which is a we were so discriminated against, you know, and saying even if making people cross the Tiber was a noble aim, the penal laws haven't worked. Rather few Catholics have crossed the Tiber, so there's no justification for them. He was opposed to the death penalty, which was a very unusual position at the time. Okay. So these were not fashionable causes. Later, he sat for Malton in Yorkshire, controlled by a well-known peer, the Marquess of Rockingham, who was also Prime Minister. Okay, I won't talk too much about his views on the American Revolution. But anyway, he's eventually paymaster of the forces, which made him very wealthy indeed, because all the money for the Army and Navy washed through his accounts. And he had to pay for it, obviously, but he's allowed to keep the interest and things like that. And then when it came to India, he was very much against Warren Hastings, who'd been Governor General of Bengal. Remember, the East India Company existed at the time and said it was the sort of the worst system of government ever. It was completely exploitative and so on. And by this time, he'd also come out in favor against the slave trade. But when the French Revolution came around, it was welcomed by many people, Fox saying it was the greatest event since the resurrection of Jesus Christ. But then Burke had initially applauded the French Revolution, but then changed his mind. Yeah, it was actually the March of the Women of Paris to Versailles. And that's where it published a revolution on the Revolution of France, Reflection on the Revolution of France, which is a riposte to the Welsh nonconformist vicar, Dr. Richard Price, A Discourse on the Love of Our Country, which is actually really a hymn of praise to the French Revolution. So Burke argued that it was just going for theories rather than practicalities, and countries had to maintain their traditions and should only evolve step by step. They shouldn't move too fast, and things were noxious to mankind when they're based on abstractions, and that rights were different in every country. So he said, Burke, he cherished Magna Carta, the rulings of the 17th century judge Sir Edward Coke, commentaries to the laws of England by Blackstone and so forth, the Petition of Right, and the French couldn't try and truncate this into just a few months and so on. So emotion matters as much as reason and so on. So he liked the chivalry of those who would want to defend the French Queen Marie Antoinette and so forth. So it's rather sentimental. But some of the more radical Whigs fell out with him. Then he became much closer to Pitt the Younger, who was the son of a Whig prime minister. Pitt the Younger, the friends of Mr. Pitt, the Pittites, as they're known empathetically, were seen as Tories. Later, they all became Tories. But formerly, they didn't belong to any party. You could be parties weren't that clear. There was no formal membership. You didn't actually sign a form and pay a membership list. There's no list of who was in a party. You're a Whig or a Tory if you called yourself one. And he said that the French Revolution couldn't last and it would end in a military dictatorship. And it did only 2 years after his death. So that was it. Anyway, so I think one of his sons was not involved in politics at all. Richard, who was his pride and joy, he went to Westminster and then Oxford University, and he was elected to Parliament and thought to be destined for great things, but he died aged 36. He died even before his father, I think. So that is Burke. But Burke, he didn't, he burnt a lot of his personal papers. So a lot of things that would have been helpful to historians, biographers don't exist. So not everybody agrees with him. And think he was preposterous to oppose the French Revolution. What were they supposed to do? Stick with absolutism? And people debate his deistic views and things like that. And the quotation often misattributed to him as saying, all that is needed for evil to do is for good men to do nothing, and so on. I'm not sure where it comes from. All right, so that is Edmund Burke, who is indeed buried in England, not in his native Ireland. There's a big statue outside Trinity College, Dublin. Toodaloo.